Good morning. It's Saturday, May 3rd, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today you'll hear the first half of an hour-long conversation with Chris Bojalian. Chris is the author of 12 novels, including The Double Bind, which was a New York Times bestseller and was released in paperback in February. His latest book, Skeletons at the Feast, published by Shea Earhart, arrives in stores this month. Chris won the New England Book Award in 2002, and his novel Midwives was a number one New York Times bestseller, an Oprah Book Club selection, a Publisher's Weekly Best Book, and a New England Booksellers Association Discovery Pick. His work has been translated into 20 languages and published in 22 countries. Two of his novels, Midwives and Past the Bleachers, have been made into movies, while two others, Before You Know Kindness and The Buffalo Soldier, are now in development for independent films. Chris has written for a wide variety of magazines, including Cosmopolitan, Reader's Digest, and the Boston Globe Sunday Magazine, and has been a Sunday columnist for Gannett's Burlington Free Press since 1992. He lives in Lincoln with his wife, the artist Victoria Bluer, and their daughter. In an ironic twist, when Chris first came to Vermont in 1987, he and I worked together in an advertising agency that was housed in the same building that now houses WOMMLP, The Radiator. I can recall standing in this office when Chris told co-workers, myself included, that his first novel had been accepted for publication. When I spoke to him last month, I began by asking if he remembered receiving that news.
I do remember the day. Ironically, my wife, who's a fine artist, had an art show in New York City. And this was in the Mesozoic period before cell phones. It was 1987. So I had to wait until she could return to my mother-in-law's apartment where she was staying so I could share with her this astonishing news that somebody other than her was actually going to get to read one of my books. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment waiting to get to talk to her because I was sitting on this astonishing news. And you know what it's like when you've got this great news that you simply can't wait to share with somebody. And because this was pre-cell phone, pre-internet, pre-digital age, and there were a couple of hours where I just was ready to burst.
How long had it been that you were trying to get that published before you got an acceptance?
The reality is that I sold my first novel very quickly.
Did you?
I did. It took me a long time to sell a short story. Okay. I amassed over 250 rejection slips before I ever sold a short story.
Wow.
But then once I sold a short story, much to my astonishment, there were agents who wanted to represent my work, one of whom took my first novel and sent it to Doubleday, St. Martin's, and a third house, I don't remember which one, but St. Martin's and Doubleday both made offers on it, which shows you how long ago this was. This was the late 1980s when I think you could publish a grocery list. Not true anymore.
No. No. Okay. I want to talk about The Double Bind for a minute, which was inspired by a certain real event, although you then took it in a very fictional direction.
Sure.
How hard is that to do, to take a real event that inspires you and then make up a storyline that fits it?
I didn't take an event in terms of, for example, the Hindenburg and write a novel about the Hindenburg. I didn't write, a novel about Antietam. It wasn't so much an event that inspired The Double Bind as it was one of those just astonishing moments. And when the moment occurred, I had no idea it was the genesis for a novel. What happened was this, the woman who runs the homeless shelter in Vermont, in Burlington, Vermont, a lovely, terrific person named Rita Markley called me up and said, "You have to come to my office. You won't believe what's here." And when Rita calls, I listen because of the monumentally good work that she does. And when I went to her office, she passed across her desk to me this cardboard box filled with old black and white photographs, so dusty, so dog-eared that I think if I were an asthmatic, I would have gone into anaphylactic shock. And I recognized instantly Flip Wilson, David Steinberg, Chuck Berry, beautiful cityscapes of Brooklyn and New York, lots of images of jazz musicians. Rita wanted me to see these photos because they'd been left behind by a man named Bob Soupy Campbell. Bob had arrived at the shelter homeless in 1999 with not a whole lot more than a duffel bag filled with his photos. He'd live in the shelter in Burlington for 3 weeks. Then they would find from the single room occupancy apartment where he would live the last 3.5 years of his life. Rita wanted me to see these photos that day in December because he died. Mm-hmm. And she thought they might make for an interesting newspaper column, sort of a way to celebrate the shelter, remind people that the homeless have often led lives that are vital and vibrant and interesting before everything goes to heck in a handbasket. Well, she was right. I researched back Bobby's life, and I learned that in the 1960s and 1970s, he had indeed been an esteemed photographer working with Variety and Backbeat, photographing theatrical and musical luminaries in New York City. But through a combination of illness and bad luck, he fell through every imaginable safety net and finally retreated to Burlington. Why Vermont? Well, I learned in my research that from 1946 to 1948, he lived in this tiny village in Addison County, Vermont, called Bristol. Mm-hmm. So, of course, I went to Bristol looking for people who might have known Bobby when he was in middle school there. And among the people I spoke with was a great guy named Sam McKinnon. Sam McKinnon was 92 when I interviewed him. His son had been good friends with Bobby Campbell. And I'd learned a lot about Bob Soupy Campbell at this point, but not everything. And I guess I'm telling you this story so you know that I'm just not the brightest bulb in the tanning bed. I was sitting across from Sam McKinnon, and I said, so why do you think people called Bobby Soupy? And Sam stands up, shuffles across the kitchen, gets a can of Campbell's tomato soup out of the pantry, plops it down on the counter between us and says, so what do you think, youngin'? If you were 12 years old and your last name was Campbell, think someone might have called you Soupy? The article ran on December 22nd, 2003, and it's the longest story I've ever written for the Burlington Free Press by far, and I've been writing for that paper. I've been writing the column since 1992, and I've been writing for the paper since 1988. The column ran 3 full newspaper pages, top to bottom, side to side, included a number of his photos. But then I was done. I did not see the double bind yet. Didn't see a novel yet. 6 months later, in June of 2004, I reread Scott Fitzgerald's The Great Gatsby. I love The Great Gatsby. I love Fitzgerald's work. I don't think anyone wrote sentences as luminescent as Scott Fitzgerald. I don't think anyone understood as well the connection between class and culture and the human heart. I finished at about 4:30 on a Tuesday afternoon. Then I had dinner with my wife and daughter. And then after dinner, I went for a bike ride on a dirt road that links my village, Lincoln, with the next village, South Starksboro. And as I was biking on this dirt road, I suddenly started thinking about Bobby Campbell's photos. And the connection was clearly The Great Gatsby. Why? Well, The Great Gatsby is set in the 1920s, an era we see through a haze of black and white photographs, and Bobby photographed exclusively in black and white. And The Great Gatsby is the ultimate jazz age novel, and Bobby Campbell loved his jazz musicians. And I was thinking about something else. My wife had heard a story on the radio that day, and it was a warning. And it was a warning that we shared with our daughter at dinner. If you're ever riding your bicycle and someone wants to abduct you, hold on to the handlebars for dear life, because it is almost impossible to throw somebody attached to their bicycle into the back of a van or a car. The geometry just doesn't work. And as I was biking, then I had the idea for the double bind, and the idea was pretty crisp that moment. I wanted to write a novel about a young female social worker who works with the homeless, the elderly once homeless photographer she befriends, and the mystery of the photos he leaves behind when he dies, though in this case, the photos wouldn't be linked simply to theatrical and musical luminaries in Greenwich Village in the 60s and 70s. It would be linked as well to her childhood on West Egg, Long Island. the swim and tennis club where she'd learned to swim and play tennis, a building that 80 years earlier had been the estate of a bootlegger named Gatsby, and the photos would be linked to a violent, savage, horrific attack on a young bicyclist with which, unfortunately, the social worker is all too intimately familiar. I knew the first sentence, and I knew the last sentence. I just didn't know the, 70,000 sentences in between.
Right.
But I knew precisely what I wanted to do with this book.
Isn't that a great feeling when the various threads come together into, a storyline?
It's the only time it's ever happened.
Yeah.
In all of my books, the Double Bind is whatever, my 10th or 11th novel. And it's the first time that I started a book knowing how it was going to end. Never happened before, hasn't happened since.
Okay, I want to talk about your new book, Skeletons at the Feast, which comes out in May. It's a departure in a couple of ways from your usual work. First of all, setting. It's not set in Vermont, which is that the first time that it's not set in Vermont?
No. Before You Know Kindness is set in New Hampshire New York City. And then, of course, I did write the single worst first novel ever published, bar none, A Killing in the Real World, set in New York City.
That was set in New York, okay. Mm. But this one's very different.
Yeah.
Very, very different. And it's also, it's different in the sense of genre because it's historical fiction. So can you just talk a little bit about how you came to write Skeletons at the Feast?
Skeletons at the Feast actually had its origins way back in 1998. A friend of mine and I were getting our two daughters at kindergarten, and he said to me, "Would you read my grandmother's diary? My mother's just translated it from German into English, and would you take a look at it?" Now, normally, when somebody says to a novelist, "Would you look at the family diary?" your immediate reaction as a novelist is, "Oh, please, just put the bamboo shoots under the nails now. just get the torture over with right away." But I'm really good friends with this fellow, and so I said, "Of course, absolutely." And I read it, and it was really interesting. His grandmother lived in Germany from the late 19th century until 1945, and through most of her adult life in Germany, she'd been the matriarch on a massive, baronial, beautiful, gorgeous estate in East Prussia. And by the standards of the 1920s and the 1930s, this was agribusiness. They grew sugar beets. And they grew sugar beets on this estate as far as the eye could see in all directions. Most of the diary is about being a wife and a mother in the 1920s and the 1930s with, all of the issues that any woman would have then in terms of sick children, healthy children, managing the farm. But then there were about 30 pages involving the Second World War. They were pretty riveting. And so I shared this diary with some folks that I knew in publishing. They all said essentially the same thing. There's a lot in here about growing sugar beets. it was never published anywhere. And then I stopped thinking about it. It was like a book that I'd read, and then you read another book and you move on, and it fell, deeper and deeper and deeper into, the gray matter behind my eyes. In 2006, I read Max Hastings' nonfiction account of the last year of the war in Germany, Armageddon. And as I was reading it, I came across scenes that were eerily familiar to me. And I realized, oh yeah, that was in the diary you read 8 years ago. Not because Max Hastings had access to this diary, but because some of the moments in it were so universal. Mm-hmm. And two immediately come to mind. First of all, the diary chronicles this woman's decision in 1945, in January, to take her family and go west, to get away from the Russian army that's about to break through the remnants of the German army in Eastern Front. And if she doesn't know the details of what atrocities the German army has committed in Russia, she now has her suspicions. And so she wants to get her daughters out of harm's way. And so she starts west. And one of the riveting scenes in the diary occurs at the Vistula River, frozen in January. And her desire to get her family across this frozen ice bridge. Meanwhile, the Soviet shells are pummeling the river, turning it into ice slivers and ice shavings. Well, there's a scene about that in Max Hastings' Armageddon. And then Max Hastings' book also talks about this bizarre, idiosyncratic footnote to history that I was unfamiliar with, but some of the British and American POWs in the autumn of 1944 were sent from the German Stalags to these massive farms in Pomerania and East Prussia to help with the harvest. Because at this point, the Nazis were out of slave labor. And, you know, every male was in the army. And so all of a sudden, you've got these British and American guys between the ages of, you know, like 18 and 25, hanging around in the fields with the German farm girls. And occasionally, these surprising romances developed. And that brought me back to the diary. Because in this diary, there's this poignant scene in which the diarist, my friend's grandmother, is talking about how it's the last Christmas Eve on the estate. She knows that pretty soon she's going to be leaving with her daughters, because pretty soon the Russians will be there. But it's lovely to watch her 16-year-old daughter and her daughter's friends, female friends, dancing with those seven lovely English boys into the wee small hours of the morning. So, you know, there were these POWs living in the house on this estate because, you know, in the diarist chronicles, it's cold. It's ridiculous for them to be in the bunkhouse.
Right.
And so I called up my friend and asked if I could see his mother's diary. He said, sure. And then I called up his mother, that 16-year-old girl back in 1945, and I said, I want to write a novel. It wouldn't be your story. It wouldn't be your mother's story, but the diary was inspirational. And I'd love to write a book that captures that period. And she said, sure. And so I immediately started trying to find Holocaust survivors, Germans, and Poles who'd been in that part of Pomerania, in that part of East Prussia, in that horrific, horrific six-month period.
Mm-hmm.
And I started interviewing them, and what emerged from it is Skeletons at the Feast. And Skeletons at the Feast is a love story, a love triangle, set in the last 6 months of the war, and the triangle is comprised of Anna Emmerich, an 18-year-old Prussian girl who's grown up on this massive baronial estate. When the novel opens, oblivious to the Nazi atrocities, her lover, a 20-year-old Scottish prisoner of war, who's been slave labor on her family's estate since the autumn.
That's Callum, right?
That's Callum, yep. And a 26-year-old German corporal who is actually a young Jewish man who jumped off a train on the way to a death camp and now in the final months of the war is masquerading as a German soldier to stay alive. And the book chronicles their desperate journey ahead of the Soviet army from the Vistula River in Poland all the way to the Rhine, if necessary, to the British and American lines. The book chronicles as well Anna's mother and siblings as they work their way west. And it follows a group of Jewish prisoners who are part of one of those horrific, inexplicable, inexcusable forced marches from the concentration camps, first in January and then in March, when the Nazis were evacuating the eastern camps and marching their prisoners west. Mm-hmm. I love this book for a lot of reasons, and I think I enjoyed writing it because it's a love story. Mm-hmm. And after the double bind, I needed to write a love story. And it's the only book I've written that when both my wife and my editor of 15 years finished it, they were sobbing. And sobbing in a good way, not because they thought my career was over. And it has a tank in it, but my wife and my editor, who are both female, said, yeah, you can have a tank, but give us a break, just one, and let's only have it appear one time.
Okay. Now, the German soldier, who's really a Jewish man in disguise, I'm sure everything's happened in the world, but I'm just curious, was that based on something you had read as well, or did you...
It's based on two things. It's based on, first of all, an account I came across in, I don't even remember which of the secondary books I read, about a woman who jumped off a train when she heard it was going to Auschwitz. There was this brief moment when she was emptying one of the slop buckets from those, you know, torturous cattle cars, and she realized, you know what? I'm just going to follow my body when I throw it over the side, and if they machine gun me, let them machine gun me. And she did it right when the train was starting to move, and she rolled into the woods to safety, and then because she could pass, as full-fledged, full-blooded Aryan, she ended up being a secretary in Berlin, working for, I don't remember what ministry, but she did that for the last 18 months of the war. It was, anyway, so Uri was inspired first by her, and then by one of my best friends on the planet, a fellow I lived with in college for a couple of years. His great uncle survived in Poland after most of his family was machine gunned because they were Jewish. He just didn't happen to be in the village when the Einsatzgruppen came through. And when the Christian Polish underground wanted nothing to do with him because he was Jewish, he realized, I have to survive any way that I can. Mm-hmm. And he spoke German fluently, and he spoke Russian fluently. And he ended up being, of all things, a translator for about 9 months in Danzig for, I think it was the Luftwaffe.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Thank you. You've mentioned a couple times some of the horrible conditions and some of the terrible things that were done, that we all know that there were terrible things done. When you're depicting that in fiction, how do you figure out how much to depict, and what's truth and honesty on the page, and what's enough for the reader? Do you know what I mean?
Like, yeah. Well, you know, you're talking to the writer who plunged a knife into a pregnant woman in a bedroom in Midwives. You know, I brought readers into the operating room for a sexual reassignment surgery in Transistor Radio.
Right.
I drowned two little girls in the first page of The Buffalo Soldier. I will never pull the curtain. I will never have, you know, ellipses, dot, 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 as much as my mother-in-law sometimes wishes I would. The thing about this particular book, Skeletons at the Feast, is that it was a level of horror, simply because, you know, there was no period in human history that I think was more violent, more horrific than the last 6 months of World War II in Poland and Germany. First of all, you've got the concentration camps that were still functioning. You've got the concentration camps that were being evacuated, with the prisoners put on these just savage forced marches. You've got the Russians being killed in numbers, the Russian soldiers being killed in numbers that are just staggering, because much of the Russian strategy was attrition. How many men can you throw at a pillbox? And you've got the German army fighting like cornered wolves, because they know what they've done in Russia. They know they can't possibly surrender to the Soviets. And then you've got the hundreds of thousands of women and children and very old people, these Germans from East Prussia and Pomerania, walking west on foot because they don't want to be caught by the Soviets. So the level of suffering was incalculable. Now, for a book like Skeletons of the Feast, I think 400 pages of torture would be unreadable. So there are scenes in the concentration camps. There are scenes among the refugees. There are some scenes of battle. But I hope they are leavened by those small moments of redemption and recovery and love.
Mm-hmm. Probably we shouldn't talk about it anymore until you read a little bit, because that way people who haven't read it will be able to have a taste of it.
So, oh, thank you.
If you wouldn't mind, maybe reading an excerpt.
Sure. One of the things I like to do is always just begin at the beginning.
Okay.
Rather than drop people into the middle of the book.
And I'm just going to interrupt you and say, this is Chris Bojalian reading from his new book, Skeletons at the Feast.
And this is from the prologue. The girl, a young woman really, 18, hair the color of corn silk, had been hearing the murmur of artillery fire for 2 days now. Everyone had. A rare and peculiar winter thunderstorm in the far distance? Little more. The sconces in the living room hadn't twitched. The chandelier in the ballroom, a modest ballroom, but a ballroom nonetheless, barely had trembled the horses. While she was harnessing them and helping to load the wagons, short trips with bags full of oats, because after all, so much would depend on the horses, and longer ones with some of the clothes and the silver and the jewelry they were going to take with them, had looked up. But the animals hadn't expressed particular interest. If, Anna surmised, they had thought of anything, they had thought of the cold. It was one of those frigid weeks when the days would alternate between whiteout like snowstorms and periods so still that the smoke from the chimneys would rise up into a slate-gray sky in lines that were perfectly straight. These shells, however, the ones that were falling this afternoon, were great concussive blasts that had the people and the horses, a seemingly endless caravan of strangers that clogged the road and crushed the snow and ice along the sides, and had come almost to a complete stall now before the river, fretting and fidgeting in place. At each explosion, the animals whinnied and the babies, hungry and chilled despite the blankets and furs in which they were swaddled, cried out. If they managed to free one of their little hands, the blue fist would lash out a small spring-loaded paddle. Clearly, however, the artillery had leapfrogged over them, past them. Hours earlier, it had been many kilometers to the east. Now it was ahead of them to the west. Some of the shells were falling so nearby that they heard the screech, a strange foreign animal, something that might exist in a tree in Africa or South America, the girl thought, before the reverberant burst left them crouching, anxious, in their places in line. At first, she presumed the Russians were trying to hit them, this long line of families trying desperately to flee to the west, to take out the carts and the wagons and the walkers piecemeal. But then she understood their real intent. It was the river itself. They were trying to smash the buttress-thick ice that coated this stretch of the Vistula from shore to shore like a skating rink and was serving as a bridge, because the nearest stone and cement overpass was 25 kilometers to the north. Along the shore, she saw soldiers and Volkssturm teenagers, boys that were easily 2 and 3 years younger than her twin brother and her, funneling the refugees across what they believed was the safest part of the ice. But she had the sense that any moment now, people were going to start leaving the queue and fanning out into the woods, where they would cross the river wherever they could, or at least believed that they could. The girl had heard stories of wagons and families disappearing yesterday and the day before through the ice to the north and the south. She wasn't sure if they were true. But so much of the last month had been a study in how things she had once thought were inconceivable were actually happening. They'd all heard what had occurred 3 months earlier in Nemersdorf. The Russians had captured the East Prussian village in October and held it for 5 days. When their own soldiers recaptured the small town, almost all of the civilians were dead. She had heard tales of girls her age and younger, nailed naked to the sides of barns and farm carts, their arms spread wide as if they were being crucified. There were stories of small children flattened into the main roads of the village by the treads of tanks, of the French prisoners of war, some people claimed as many as 40 of them, who had been executed by the Russians for reasons that no one could fathom. And then there were the stories of what her own people had done. That is, of course, in the mind of Anna Emmerich, 18 years old, arriving at the Vistula River with her family as refugees. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed that first half of a conversation with Chris Bojalian. Next week, tune in at 9 a.m., half an hour early, if you'd like to hear a repeat of this week's show, and then continue listening at 9:30 to hear the second half of the interview. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, do let them know they can stream it every Saturday morning at www.theradiator.org. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes as free podcasts. If you have comments about the show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, in Burlington.